very much for inviting me back to this part of the world. My gratitude goes to David Hamayunfa for arranging the soul, and especially to Gateways for giving me the opportunity to share with you this evening on a very painful subject of dealing with difficult people, dealing with different people. I think the two are really synonymous. How many husbands and wives have quarreled because of differences that remained unresolved to the point that the marriage broke up? How many children have suffered because they were exposed to unresolved differences that mom and dad had in the difficulties that came up between them, and how they were affected into adolescence and maybe into their own social skills of dating and then marriage themselves and beyond, even in their raising of children? How many families, because of unresolved differences, end up not communicating with each other? Or even, God forbid, communities, either between the leader and senior members of the community or others, because they didn't see eye to eye in handling the differences or difficulties that came up, split the entire community. And the list goes on. Businesses that went under, not because the product or service wasn't what it should be, not because they didn't have the skills and the assets, the financial backing, but because either partners or in the various departments, people were not able to find a way to get along with each other, and slowly it affected the profit margin, the bottom line, and eventually, God forbid, the business had to close down. And when we look at it on the global scale, unresolved differences between nations or between religions that have caused the deaths of innocent lives, we're going to try and keep it local today and just keep it to dealing with those who are different and difficult in my personal life. Not my personal life, but in genetically speaking, generally speaking. Let us ask a simple question. What are the typical results of unresolved differences and unresolved difficulties between a husband and a wife, between siblings? What are the most typical consequences, short term, long term? Anger, jealousies, hatred, a very deep emotion. I could have had love for this person, and it turns into resentment, bitterness, and even hatred. So we've got jealousy, anger, hatred, bitterness. What else are the frustration, at least on the simplest level? I'm just frustrated that these difficulties keep coming up, and we get entangled, and somehow they don't get resolved, and we both walk away with a feeling of dissatisfaction from the entire encounter. The experience never seems to be a happy or satisfying one. Anything else we want to mention on this on the unhappy list? I'm going to get to the... Sorry? It's an unending list almost. What else can we add? We've got bitterness, frustration, anger, hatred, jealousy. Resentment. I could have resentment for weeks, months, and years. Is it possible that my resentment, I could even get used to the resentment to the point that I cover it up just to be able to get on and function in this relationship, in this business, in this family, with these difficult parents, until I'm freed of them somehow or other, and the resentment is still building up, being reinforced each time there's a frustration or a feeling of hatred or jealousy? And is it possible that that resentment could create an explosion, the breaking up of the relationship, the 27 years married, and suddenly they get divorced? But I don't understand. Well, 27 years, and the answer is it possible that resentment for the differences that remained unresolved, I was not listened to, I was not sufficiently understood, you didn't really even try the way I was begging you to try to empathize or be emotionally a bit more involved in my life, or a bit more affectionate, or just understand why I raised the kids this way, or why my financial principles work this way, and the resentment and the bitterness builds up over years and then even decades, and I remain in an unhappy relationship because I've got someone who's different and difficult, and it remains unresolved. So we've got a gamut of very negative and painful emotions. What are we supposed to do with them? Is there a way that I can break through this so that somehow I can either learn to get along with, or maybe even change the other person? Now let me ask you, I'm not sure if I want you to have a show of hands, but if you could raise your hand in your mind, is there anyone in this room who's wanted to change another person and found that they were successful in changing the other person by trying to change the other person? Is there anyone who knows anyone who has successfully changed another person by trying to change that other person? And if they did, at any level, was it because they succeeded in getting that person to want to change, or only out of fear, manipulation in the moment for the sake of peace? Okay, I'll do it. All right, I'll listen to you. And they cooperated. Behitzoniot, only outwardly. But inwardly, there's no rewiring. So, let's understand something. Why is it that I find you difficult or different? Because I really want, if I put this under the microscope, I want you to change. I want you to be more like me. Think more like me. Look at raising children, being married, running the business. I want you to look at it and feel the way I feel. So in a sense, the fact that I've identified you as different or difficult, inside that view of you is my desire for you to change. Why is it that whenever someone tries to change me, I resist? Why is it so in human nature to resist change being forced or even nicely wrapped? But when it's you trying to change me, no matter how nicely wrapped it is, I really don't want to change. Why is that? What is it about my resistance to change that makes it so? Don't interfere. I am me. If you can't accept me as I am, then go elsewhere. Go to wherever you want. Don't try and change me. Why is it I'm so resistant to that? Even if you're right. Even when you're correct, even when you're not only intellectually correct, you may even be right emotionally, that I really do need to change. I need to be more responsible in the way I'm running the finances. I need to be more loving. I need to be more affectionate. I need to be more involved with this child. And you're asking, maybe in the nicest way possible, why can't I be more amenative? Why can't I be more accommodative? Why can't I be more cooperative? Why can't I be a better listener and say, I see. You mean it would be better for me, it would be better for everyone? So I've got to change. Why won't I do it? Why do I resist? Unfortunately, the answer is that my desire to change you is dealing with the most sensitive area that has been created in a human being. Free will. For me to go inside of you and tell you to change the way you look at me, the way you talk, the way you behave, the way you raise this kid, any way which way I want you to change, by my desire for you to change, what I'm really tampering with is the most sensitive part of your makeup. And that is the desire for independence. That when I make a decision, let it be a decision that's born from my own self. Let me own that decision. But if I change because you want me to change, or you convince me to change, who's doing the changing? I'm not changing. You're changing me. So I don't own it. I'm just doing it because I agree with you. Even if you're right, you've hurt me. Because instead of me figuring this out myself, you've come along and said, I guess you don't really have the intelligence to figure this out yourself, but you really need to change. You have to become more loving, more affectionate, more understanding, more sympathetic, more empathetic, more better listener, more involved with this child. And essentially, what you've really done to me has insulted my intelligence, that I don't have the tools or the intelligence, the capacity to figure this out on my own. You're interfering with my freedom of choice. I need to own the decision to change, and I need to own the actions that make me change. I'll give you a very simple example. Imagine on a Saturday afternoon, you're taking a nice Shabbat rest. after you took the world's fastest sleeping tablet, Charland. And there you are, snoring away, enjoying a good dream, and suddenly, you don't believe it, you're suddenly woken up. I cannot believe it. You know what it is? Your 16-year-old is bouncing his basketball right outside the bedroom window. He's woken me up from my... I don't work hard enough during the week that I don't deserve a bit of a rest from this 16-year-old bouncing his ball. Mike, do you mind having a little bit of respect for your father? Could you stop bouncing that ball? I'm trying to take a rest. Guess what Mike does for the next 5 seconds? Carries on bouncing. And then he stops. Why did he have to carry on bouncing the ball for another 5 seconds? And then why could he just stop when I told him to please stop? What's that about? And the answer is, if Michael stops bouncing the ball immediately after I asked him to, who stopped him bouncing the ball? Me. Oh, I interfered with his freedom of will. But if he carries on bouncing the ball and then stops a few seconds later, who stopped bouncing the ball? He owned it himself. Now guess what I do? You brat! I asked you to stop bouncing and you carried on just to get me angry! Is it possible? That was pretty well done. You thought I was acting, right? So just a wake-up call. Is it possible that I totally misinterpret his continual bouncing? I think it's about getting me more annoyed. He's going to show, oh, you want me to stop bouncing? I'll stop when I feel like it. No, it's not arrogance. It's his need to be independent, to be himself. He needs to own the stopping so that he's respecting me because he's respecting me and not because I dictate he respects me. And I go and blow it by screaming at him that he's a brat for continuing the bouncing even after I asked him to stop. I don't understand that it's really about interfering with the most sensitive part of our makeup, freedom of choice. But wait a minute, if I can't say anything, if I can't recommend anything to my own husband, my own wife, my own child, well, how am I supposed to get them to change? And the answer is again, do we know anyone who changed anyone by trying to change them? We don't know anyone. No adult, even child, wants to be changed by force, even if it's well wrapped. So then what's the answer? Sorry? Wait for 5 seconds. It's still 5 seconds, he hasn't changed yet. But you're very warm. The answer is, if there's no God, I'm left trying to change everything that I don't like in my life. Whether it's my health, whether it's my financial status, whether it's my social status, whether it's who's in my life, I'm busy trying to change all those factors, all those people. But what happens if we add God to the equation? If we add God to the equation, is it possible that then I have to admit, who is responsible for my choice of parents? Did I choose my parents? Did I choose my siblings? Did I choose the culture I was born into? Did I choose the education that I received? Did I choose my friends in the school that I was sent to? Not really. If I can see, you know what? God sent me all the different people that I never controlled in my life for a simple reason. It's the training ground for dealing with different people and difficult people. Is there a family on earth in history that we can identify where the husband and wife agreed all the time? That the children always cooperated with mum and dad? Always nodded their head, yes mum, yes dad? Sorry? In the movie called Yes, It Happened? Yeah, well, guess what? They didn't have free will. They were reading someone else's script. Ah. Movies have the license to not be real. You look at the first family on earth. How successful was Adam and Eve in engendering wonderful sibling love? Sibling rivalry starts in chapter 4 of Genesis, and it was so unresolved it ended up in murder. The first case of manslaughter. This is terrible. And if that's not enough, you don't have to go that much further till you get to chapter 16. And Hagar, the co-wife of Abraham, invited to join the family by Sarah, her mistress, raises a child, Ishmael. And then when Isaac comes onto the scene, the true son of both Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Ishmael get along with each other? No! Ishmael attempts assassination! So Sarah says to Abraham, you know what, this is not working out. Ishmael's playing bows and arrows, and Isaac is the target! We can't have this! So Hagar was thrown out the house, chapter 16 in Genesis. It didn't work out. Oh, you don't have to go that much further, chapter 25. Esau and Jacob, twins in the womb, go very separate ways. Esau sells his birthright. Jacob deceives Esau in chapter 27 by impersonating him in order to get the blessings. And from then on, Esau swears to be the arch enemy of Jacob and his descendants forever. And we've suffered from the sons of Ishmael, the sons of Esau. Unresolved sibling rivalry. It's right there in the Torah. Wait a minute, shouldn't the Torah be a nice book that starts off, once upon a time there was a happy husband and a happy wife, and they had happy children, the children cooperated, listened to mom and dad, and it was a beautiful role model of how it should be, and then they all lived happily ever after. What a great script. Sounds like music. Why didn't they do that? Because what is reality? Is reality choosing a spouse who's most like me and least different to me? Or is reality choosing a spouse who I think is most like me and least different to me and discovering that there are many differences that I had never known or anticipated were going to surface between us? And as much as I try to mold my child by choosing the right school, neighborhood, friends, community, do I really own the variables that affect how my child thinks? How they are treated in the school by a teacher that does not understand my kid? That perhaps even takes sides against my own child? And that the child is cooperative for years and holds in a resentment for that many years too, until they become a teenager, when they crave independence, and now they have to be independent. If we're going to talk about trying to change other people, this is the end of the lecture, because it ain't going to happen. The only person I can change is me. No, not you, me. The only person I can change is me. That's the only person I have any control over their free will is me. But then how's that going to help changing you, my dear spouse, child, brother, mother, in-law, father? How's changing me going to help change you? And the answer is, if I'm changing me in the way I behave to you, talk to you, think about you, is it possible that you will no longer be dealing with the same me? Oh, you won't be responding with the same me. You might not want to trust me at the beginning. He's changed. I wonder if this is for real. So you're not going to trust it right at the beginning. But what happens if we keep trying and struggling? The only person I have any chance of changing is myself, not anyone else. God deliberately sends different, difficult, contrary people in my life. Spouse, children, siblings, parents, parents-in-law, extended members of the family, community leaders, community members, co-worker, partner, business partner, boss, client, landlord. There's no one, not a single person, that basically fits my mold. Unbelievable. God, what sort of a game is this? Be nice. Be nice to me. Send me nice people, that a gentle nature that I can get along with, and I don't have to get into these arguments with the differences. And God says, no, that's not the purpose of growth. Growth only comes from dealing with different and difficult people. It's the name of the game. So, you mean you're signing us up for pain? Oh, no, no, no. the purpose of the different people in my life are there to help me change what I need to change in me to become more sensitive, a better listener, more empathetic to someone else's pain, more sharing in their joy and celebrating their successes, being more involved with that child, being more involved with my spouse, caring more about what's going on in their lives, caring about the things that they're sensitive about, even if I'm not sensitive about those things. But learning to be sensitive because it matters to them is my loyalty, devotion, and expression of love. That it bothers me that you're in pain. Even though the very cause of your pain would not bother me, but it bothers me that it bothers you because you're my spouse. Loyalty, love, devotion is not dependent on your performance. It's not dependent on how well you behave, because if I make my love for you, my devotion to you, my loyalty to you dependent on you agreeing with me, being similar to me, have we discovered a potion of love, devotion and loyalty that is really workable? Or is this dependent on performance? Oh, if I define my love for you as when you're affectionate to me, when you're understanding, when you're empathetic, when you're devoted to me, then I'll love you back. Have I created real love, or have I created a love that gives someone else all the power, and I'm not going to take responsibility for being loving in this relationship? Because I'm going to accuse you of not being enough loving to me, and I'm going to blame you, and I'm going to complain about you, and I'm going to deny that it's really my problem. I'm going to give excuses for why it's really your fault. And in the end, if I can do A, B, C, D, E, A, accuse you, B, blame you, C, complain about you, D, deny it's my fault, and E, give excuses that it's my responsibility, it's really yours. If I can do these A, B, C, D, E's, what I've effectively done is made you the problem. Not you personally, but when I get you to be the one who's blameworthy, and I'm complaining about you, who has to change?
You.
Right! You have to change. I don't have to change. It's your fault. You become more responsible. And if I can blame you, how much responsibility do I have to take to make this relationship work? Zero. You prove yourself. Comes along the Torah and tells me the purpose of a different spouse, a difficult child, is not for me to change them. It's for me to change me by becoming a more appreciative, grateful and loving spouse, father, mother, parent, grandparent, parent-in-law. It's not about changing other people, because there's no one on earth who successfully changed another person by trying to change another person. Even races, communities, nations that were forced to change, if they had to, it was only by force of strength. But underneath, the rebellion was there. Resentment was there. Let me share with you the following. If it's really true that the focus of changing other people is really not about trying to change you, it's all about me, then what I have to start to recognize is that if God really is in the picture, then we see something very interesting. The word argumentation, division, separation between people, the word in Hebrew for that term is what? Predai, separation. What is the word that most frequently use when we describe people in argumentation and differences? Machloket. Machloket. What is the Hebrew language called in Hebrew? Ivrit. That's modern Hebrew. What's the original name? Lashon HaKodesh. What does Lashon HaKodesh translate as? Holy tongue. God's holy tongue. See, if this is really a holy tongue, if this is God's language, then if it's a divine language, that surely means that if we know the real meaning of the letters and how they combine, that would mean that God's mind could be discovered if we understand the meaning of the word. That word describes reality. It's not just a human choice of a word. No, in that word describes the reality of what it is. Machloket, dissension, division, separation, argumentation. What is the three-letter root of the word machloket? Chelek. What does chelek mean?
Part.
It means a part. Why? Because when I look at what I don't like about you, am I looking at all of you? Why did I agree to get into a relationship with you in the first place? And the answer is, because of what I don't like about you? No! About your virtues, what I do like about you. What is machloket? What is anger? What is resentment? What is bitterness? Looking at the entire person or the parts about the person I don't like, I don't agree with. Machloket comes from one chelek. Chelek means only part. I'm only looking at a part of you. If I read only one or two pages or one or two chapters of an entire book, and I don't like what I've read, am I in a position to judge the book? If I don't see the entire movie, only 5 or 10 minutes, am I in a position to judge the movie? I just saw a part of the movie. That's not enough for me to come away with a fair assessment, with a fair judgment. What is the word that is in complete contrast to argumentation, dissension, differences? Shalom. What is the three-letter root of the word shalom? Shalem. What does shalem mean? Complete. Oh, interesting. Why is shalom between people possible? Because there's a complete understanding about where you're really coming from. Is it possible that even our own spouse, if we were to watch a movie of how they were raised in their home, the experiences they went through in school, is it possible that the complaints I've had against my spouse and the judgments I've had against my spouse, is it possible that if I were to see the challenges they had when they were raised by their parents, and maybe even watch a movie to see how their parents were raised, is it possible my anger, resentment, hatred sometimes, judgment, is it possible that my complaints could switch to compassion and understanding and maybe even appreciation and love? Wow, that's what you went through? I don't think I could have gone through the same and come out as strong as you really are. Is it possible if we saw a movie of what was going through the mind of our child when they were hurt or humiliated, even by myself, their own parent, and certainly by their friends in school, their teacher, or by the principal in front of the entire assembly? Is it possible if I were to see what I don't see, and I got the fuller picture of where my own kid, my own child is coming from, is it possible that picture would change the way I feel, think, talk to, and behave towards that child? The whole concept of complaining, the whole concept of machloket, is based on, I'm complaining about what I don't like about you, and what I don't like about you is only a chelek, it's only part of the real you. Because when we get down to the grassroots of where we're both coming from, if I want to understand what the boss is going through in his private life, what the co-worker and the client is going through in their private life, good chance I would not start up with them. Good chance I would judge them differently. Is it possible that I do the same to myself? That sometimes I don't give my own self sufficient compassion? Because I'm looking at what I don't like about me, what I don't like about my performance as a spouse, as a parent, in the workplace, what I don't like in my personal growth, what I don't like about I haven't made enough progress in my spiritual growth, is it possible that I get so judgmental and down on my own self that the one person who I need more than anyone else to be there for me, my own self, is not there for me because I'm busy complaining about me? And therefore I become more believing in other people's complaints about me. I'm complainable because I don't always like what I see in my own self. Maybe I need to learn more love, appreciation, compassion for my own self as a training to be that way to others as well. So if we're looking for solutions by trying to change others, that's an old recipe which has been tried and tested again and again and again. And that's why the divorce rate is what it is. That's why there are millions of children suffering from homes that are broken or are going to be broken. Unresolved differences, and my attempt to resolve them is mostly focused on changing the other person. Because that's the easy way out. It doesn't work because I'm interfering with the most sensitive wiring that exists in your emotion, your soul, and your entire mental makeup. I'm attempting to rewire you. I'm taking a piece of your identity out of you. I'm making you be what I want you to be. And take questions in a few minutes. That immediately creates the red alarm. Don't enter my space. Don't try and change me. Because if you do, you're going to make me feel like a nothing. I'm not me. I'm just being an extension of you. So I'm going to sacrifice my life to be and to behave and to talk and to listen the way you want me to be. And guess what? If I try that route, will I be satisfied? I might be able to act it out for a while, but is it possible the resentment for trying is not really going to work? And let me ask you, are you going to respect me for not being my real self? Or deep down, you're not even going to respect me for trying to be like you? Because you're going to see, oh, I'm so weak, I'm so manipulative, I'm easily manipulated. You're not even going to end up respecting me for trying to be like you and acquiescing to your desire for me to change. The only way that you'll respect me is if I don't try to change for your sake. I try to change myself. Without your cajoling, without your reminding, without your nagging, without your judgments, and without your threats. If the bottom line is that my complaint about another person is my attempt to change them, then what would be the antidote, so to speak, of turning that around? Because if it's true that complaints is the anatomy of my anger towards you, I'm complaining about what I don't like about you. If it's true that my hatred and resentment really boils down to, I'm complaining about what I don't like about you. That complaint contains a statement, I want you to change. If that's true, then what would be the, so to speak, the recipe that would correct that? What would be the ingredients I need to correct that? Because if it's complaints that engenders a feeling of resentment in you, that makes you angry back at me, and make you not want to change, what do I need to do to make you want to change? To change myself.
What if that the complaint of people about is negative?
What would be an example so that I can answer you more specifically? Without working with an exact example, it would be very hard for me to answer specifically. But generally speaking, if I attempt to communicate to you your need to change, the guarantee, not 99%, 100% guarantee, you're probably going to resent it. If you're extremely humble and real big into personal growth, you might listen to an extent and make some changes. But ultimately, my purpose is not to be your coach. My purpose in coming into your life is not, I'm not here to fix you. I'm here to fix myself. If I'm so tied into a relationship with you that I have to work with you, I have to deal with you, you're my spouse, you're my child, you're my parent, you're an in-law, and until you get killed or assassinated or I have to deal with you, right? I haven't got a choice. The only way that I'll ever succeed in getting you to be different in the way you handle me is by me handling you differently, by me changing. It's the only way. And what we're talking about over here is this. My complaint, in any which way, how well wrapped it is, ultimately you're going to pick up, whether you're sensitive or insensitive, you will pick up that I'm complaining about you. You don't want me. I don't want you to be the way you are. And you will be hurt by that. You might be very diplomatic, but bottom line is you're going to be hurt by it. The only thing that does work, and that can work, is that if I change the complaint, I say, you know what, I'm going to ignore for now this page in the book. I'm going to turn to a different page, and guess what? Who's writing the book? I write tomorrow, the next day. What happens if I change the recipe in the next encounter? And then instead of judging the child, I sit down and say, you must be going through a difficult time. Maybe the reason you're waking up 1-2 o'clock in the afternoon is you don't feel there's anything to wake up for, to live for. If I start working with that possible assumption, instead of assuming, you lazy bum, how are you ever going to get a career waking up at 11 o'clock in the morning? Are you nuts? You're crazy? You're 17, you're 18 years old? What's the matter with you? Don't become a bum! One second! All these statements are based on assumptions. How do I know I have all the information to be absolutely certain that those assumptions are totally correct, absolutely accurate? Maybe my own child, I am unaware of how many times they've been put down, or they have low self-esteem, for whatever reasons, and the reason why they don't get up in the morning is because they're not motivated, not because they're lazy. They feel life hasn't got anything for them to offer. What am I waking up for? Maybe I need to become more understanding, more empathetic, less judgmental, and open up the possibility of dialogue. Oh, communication. If I'm not judging my child, I'm less judgmental of him, of her. Is it possible that they will feel more safe to start being honest about their fears and what's going on in their life? And in the dialogue, the communication that could hopefully create, they will start opening up what's really bothering them. And then we can possibly solve it. But if I'm left with my judgments and my assessments, and I'm not even really listening, because I'm not even asking. I'm not saying, why aren't you getting up? Why aren't you trying to get a better career? Why aren't you furthering yourself in life? No, stop trying to prod. Stop trying to interfere and rewire the other person, even if they're my spouse. What happens if I change it around and say, you know something? I have a feeling that I have not been fair in the way I've treated you. I may be wrong, but I have a feeling that I have not been fair in the way I've judged you. I have a feeling that if I were to understand what's really hurting you, instead of me keeping these assumptions and these accusations and these judgments, I would probably start listening very deeply, and I might even feel the pain that you're actually experiencing. Is it possible that just by listening and being less judgmental, by smiling and kissing and hugging more frequently our children and our spouse, with no other agenda other than, you know what, if I've got a right to complain, by the same logic, do I not also owe you appreciation for what is good? What you have done, what you do bring to the relationship? If I think I've got a right to complain, I have the same obligation and duty to appreciate and verbally say what I love about you. I have a rabbi in Los Angeles. There's a dayan there. His name is Rabbi Elchanan Tauber. And he has a custom at his Friday night table that every child has to say one thing they love about a sibling and about mommy and about daddy. And a very loving atmosphere is born from the accumulative compliments and appreciation. And he has another rule in this house. You are allowed to complain about anything that you feel you have a right to complain to your father, your mother, your brother, your sister. The only condition is, before you make the complaint, you have to say one thing that you like about that person. Think about it for a moment. Think about it for a moment. If I had to ask for a show of hands, how many of us can identify the three major problems my child has? The three major weaknesses my spouse has? How fast could we raise our hands? Question, different question. If I had to identify the three major virtues, the good points of my spouse, of my child, how fast would my hand rise? Think about it. It would take me a few more seconds, a few more moments. My own closest of kin. How could it be? Because the power of complaint is the power of chelik. I'm looking only at a part of the person. And the power of shalom is that I'm assuming, even if I don't see the whole picture, I'm assuming there's a much bigger picture. And if I were to see the movie of the beginning of where the picture began, I would not be looking at a chelik of you. I'd be looking at the bigger picture. And I would love you for what you go through and what you've been through and how strong you are. Even though I've been complaining about how weak you are, maybe I would feel very differently about you. So hidden in the very words is the concept that shalom means assuming there's much more virtue than I'm noticing. And that by smiling and kissing and hugging my own spouse, my own child, in an appropriate way, you know what I'm really saying? Without saying a word, I'm happy you exist in my life. by greeting them with a hearty greeting, "My darling husband, how are you? It's great to have you home. Even though I had a hard day." Does that mean I don't owe my spouse my face? And who did God give my face for? Me? The mirror? No! My face belongs to you! And the proof is, I can't see it! My face belongs to everyone else! Especially my husband, my wife, my children. If I had a hard day at work, and I really mean a hard, I mean, my boss, you cannot believe how abusive and unappreciative he's been today. It disgusts me. I bust my tail, I probably do the work of 3 workers. I get paid less than them. And I've been working for the company longer than all 3 combined. That's how unappreciated I feel. And I come home after a hard day. Does that mean I have a right not to smile to my child, my wife? Does that? No! My face does not belong to me! But I had a hard day. Oh, I had a hard day. Okay, so we'll discuss that separately. But my family deserve a happy smile. And the reason why, even if I lose $50,000 on a stock exchange today, and that's a reason not to smile when I come home. But let me ask you, what are my true assets? The money in the stock exchange or the children? My spouse? Which is more valuable? Now, I know some of us, it's a difficult question to answer. But seriously speaking, when forced against the wall, we'll spend thousands upon tens of thousands of dollars to save my child's education, his mind, her mind. If I had to admit, what are my true assets? Health? Family? My kids? Oh. Even if I lose 50,000 plus on the stock exchange in one day, but my true assets are untouched. I come home, they're alive and healthy, and they're growing. These assets are growing! Oh, and they need to be nurtured. If I spend every few moments that I have spare watching NASDAQ to see how my investments are growing, what about the investment of my own family? Don't they deserve at least a smile, the greeting, the hearty, loving kiss and hug that only says one thing? I'm so happy you're in my life. Even before I've said a single compliment. Is it possible that by keeping up just the hugs, the smiles, the kisses and the greetings, that those alone create the more bigger picture that is more complete of the bigger context, that I'm consistently happy you exist in my life? So that when differences do surface, when difficulties come between us, there's a context of those difficulties. Example, what is the word we say when we say, "Hi, how are you" in Hebrew? What do we say? Shalom. And what do we say when we say goodbye? Shalom. What's going on over here? Shalom, peace. And shalom, peace. We shake hands, hug, depending on how close we are, kiss each other hello, kiss each other goodbye. Why? Why shalom at the beginning and shalom at the end? And there's a powerful reason. Our sages want us to understand that the beginning of an encounter, that first impression of how happy that person is to see you, is your immediate measure of, does the person still like me? Are they still in a relationship with me? Or are they upset maybe with me? No. That hearty smile, that shake of the hand, that hug of a spouse says, I'm so happy you're in my life. And then when we say goodbye, we do the same thing. Why? And here's a very powerful explanation. Because whatever takes place in between are the differences and the difficulties that surface between us. But we say shalom at the beginning and shalom at the end to remind ourselves and the other person that it's in the context of, I am happy you exist in my life. The differences will always be there, and there'll be more, and the difficulties will be more. Raising the teenagers, oh boy! You know, one person, one woman, when she gave birth, 14 hours of labor was not easy. And she told her Rebbe, you know, I now understand. And the Rebbe said, no, you don't. You only understand Gidul Bonim, raising the kid. You don't understand what's pain. wait till they're teenagers. Oh, boy. Teenagers, not easy. But is it possible that if thousands of times that child saw mum and dad come home, oh, Chaim, how you doing, Sola? Oh, you're so special. I love you. I love you in my life. I will always love you no matter what. No intellectual statements. No big, deep insights about their character and personality. No amazing compliments. Just a cuddle and a kiss. And a hearty greeting. And the same when they say goodbye to their child off to school. Is it possible that thousands of times that that child got that from mum and dad, that the differences that will come up and will surface will be in the context of shalom and shalom? Is it possible that that will allow that even if there will be, not if, when there will be differences, it will still be in the context of dialogue, of communication, because a child knows that mom and dad, for all their faults, and for all their miscommunications, and for their inability to understand what's going on in my life, I know they love me. It's in the context of shalom. Shalom is love. Shalom is peace. This is what we're talking about. My attempt not to change you, but to change me. That's what God sent me into the world to do. Not to change anyone other than myself. And the more we change ourselves, the more we change those who we come into contact with. The greatest individuals in Jewish history were people who changed themselves the most. And that's what they were known for. Not for how many people they touched. But if they touched many people, it's because they touched themselves the most. And guess what made them move? Accelerated their pace of growth. Having lots of easy, supportive family in their lives, or very difficult people. Abraham, betrayed by his father. In psychology, the emotion of betrayal is possibly the most painful a person could experience. Of a parent betraying the child? Terach betrays his son and hands him in for execution. How do you think Abraham felt about that? Whoa, that's not an easy thing to apologize for. Did he have easygoing parents? Not at all. How about Rivka? Who were her parents? Betuel, a sick man. Her brother, Lavan, a gangster, a liar, a cheat. She makes Larry Hagman in Who Killed JR look like Pooh Bear. Many of our patriarchs and our matriarchs had the worst families. So how do they come out so amazing? And the answer is, it's not who's difficult and who's different in my life that will be the measure of how strong I become. It's how I respond to who is in my life. It's not you, it's about me. How I change, how I become more understanding, more loving, more appreciative. At first it's not going to work, they're not going to trust me. And they might even be manipulative of my goodwill and my love. But we have a statement, Ava doiche et hakol, love conquers everything. This statement says, nothing has the power to stand up to love. I'll tell you a true story that my Rebbe, Rabbi Greenwald, in Muncie, shared with me, that a lady called him up and said, Rabbi, I've owed this phone call to you for many years. I have to tell you, a couple of years ago I called you, totally distraught, was beside myself. I have a teenager boy. He gets up 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon. He stays up all night listening to his music. He's sleeping all day long. He has no motivation. I don't know where I went wrong. All my older children, they're married, responsible positions in society, they hold prestigious positions in the world of Jewish education and business, and this son, I don't know what, I don't know where I went wrong with him. He has no desire for work, to study, and he won't go in the same path of his parents. He's defiant to our faces. And I don't know what to do. I've tried everything. And Rabbi Greenwald, you know what you told me? There's a lot I can still do. I said, what is that? He said, the love that only a mother has for a child, that the child will cannot get anywhere else. Because the mother and the father are the only references of unconditional love. Rabbi, you gave me that speech and I told you, I've heard about unconditional love before. It doesn't work. And shall I tell you when it doesn't work, Rabbi? Because when your child is defiant in your face, when he shows no sensitivity for your heritage, which your grandparents died in the Holocaust for, how am I supposed to have unconditional love when that's what he puts in my face? And Rabbi, when I asked you that question, you know what you answered me? You said to me that I should remember that in the moment that my son is defiant in my face, and I don't feel unconditional love, I feel like killing the kid. I wish him dead. I feel ashamed of that feeling, but I do feel that. Rabbi, you know what you told me? To remember that God loves me even when I don't behave. Even when I don't do what I'm supposed to do. Even when I don't pray with proper devotion. Even when I don't learn as I should. Even when I don't keep the mitzvahs as I should. God still loves me. And when you told me that, you said, contain that thought that God still loves me. I owe that to my child too. And so you know what I did, Rabbi Greenwald? The next day, I prepared a feast of a breakfast. The best crockery and silverware, the most delicious foods that I know he loves. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon when he woke up, I said, Chaim, your favorite food is waiting for you, breakfast in the kitchen when you're ready. And my son walked in with his pajamas. Thanks, Mom. And had a feast. And Rabbi Greenwald, I did this every day. I stopped being judgmental. It was not easy to swallow who his friends were, his hairstyle, choice of clothes, choice of language. But I decided that maybe I will not succeed in changing him by trying to change him. So I changed myself. My husband thought I was a bit nuts. But I kept this up. And Rabbi Greenwald, he turned himself around. Today he's married. He has 2 daughters. And at his Shabbat table, he invites boys who, like he was, not found themselves, haven't got their own identity. And I will tell you this, Rabbi Greenwald, of all my children, this son is my most devoted. He's the most devoted child I have to my husband and myself. True story. And I'm going to tell you the sequel to this story. A few months ago, I told a story over a year ago in a Gateway seminar. And a gentleman came up to me a few months ago and said, you remember that I was discussing with you my teenage boys? One of them has an earring in his lip. The other one, a whole score of earrings on his ear. Well, I want to tell you, you told me the story about Rabbi Greenwald about a year ago. And you didn't know then that I had spent my 16 years and 18 years being a father to these two boys, the most unforgiving father you can imagine. So rigid, I believed this discipline was the only way. And I had so little communication with these two boys that they were totally uninterested in me and my entire lifestyle. And when you told me that story about Rabbi Greenwald, I realized that my mistake was I had spent 16 and 18 years with these two boys trying to mold and change them. And for the first time I realized I hadn't been a loving father the way they deserved me to be for them. And I turned myself around. I stopped judging them. I stopped complaining. And I started telling them what I liked about them and their personality. And I'll tell you the truth. They're no closer to Judaism than they were a year ago when you first told me the story. But I will tell you that never a Friday night goes by without both my sons coming home and asking me for a Friday night blessing. Wherever they are, they will call home and ask my advice. They never ask my advice about anything. Why is that? Because every child craves boundaries and love from their parents in the early years. And if they don't get it then, it isn't too late. They may have been so hurt that they don't want it from me, and it'll take a lot to turn them around, because it will take a lot for me to turn myself around, depending on how far away I had distanced myself from my own kids by trying to change them all the time, which sends a very powerful and harsh message. I don't trust you to change yourself without me nagging, reminding, cajoling, guiding, demanding, dictating. I'm your father, I'm your mother. And if I don't tell you, who's going to tell you? You're going to wait till your marriage partner tells you that it's too late? They're going to be sickened by what you are. That's the way to speak to my teenager? Oh my gosh! Of course the teenager's going to recoil, resent, resist. They're in the whole midst of discovering themselves and their identity, and I'm telling them how to live? I had 12, 13 years to role model how to live. And if I didn't, for whatever reason, succeed, this is not the time to role model by telling them. No, I've got a role model by changing myself. And it's all based on a verse in the Torah. I'm going to close in a few moments. The Torah tells us in chapter 14 in Deuteronomy, Banim atem l'Hashem Elokechem. You are God's children. And the Talmud in Kiddushin asks the question, when God says that we're His children, does that mean conditionally? Like only when we behave like His children, then we're His children. But if we don't behave like His children, oh, that's not my kid. No, says Rabbi Meir in the Gemara, Benkach u Benkach. Whether you behave like my child or you don't behave like my child, Banim atem Hashem Elokechem. You're still my children. The Sanzer Rav, a Hasidic Rebbe, had a son who was not going in the way of the rest of the family and the dynasty. And it was a terrible shame and embarrassment to the community. And the leaders, amongst them different congregants, decided they were going to create a litigation and go to the Rebbe at his appointed time when he would meet people after his morning devotions and tell him, Rebbe, we can't have your son in the community anymore. He's a bad role model. He's a bad influence. And they were ready to give him all their reasons. And they arrived at his front door at the appropriate time. And then when the door's supposed to open, they overhear a loud conversation that the Rebbe is having with his creator. He says, Rabbeinu Shlalom, Master of the Universe, I have a son. He's not what he should be. He doesn't take his studies seriously. He's not devoted to the mitzvot as he should be. But what am I supposed to do? He's my son. I'm his only father. If I reject him, who is he going to have? And I tell you, Rabban Shalom, not only am I telling you he's my son, but if anyone were to come and tell me to throw him out of the community, I would say, how dare you speak to me that way? He's my son! He's the only son I have! Even if I have other sons, he is my only son! Who he is my only son! God, you threw us out of your house 2,000 years ago. We don't behave the way we should. Take us back. I would never throw my son out of my house. The delegation understood the answer to their question. Banim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem. Understanding that my child, my spouse, my co-worker, they've got their story. Even if I don't know their story, I can assume they have one. And I can assume their parents have a story too. And their parents-in-law. Everyone has their story. And there will come a time. There will come a time when God is going to play back the movie all the way back from the beginning of our lives till the end. And we will have compassion on ourselves. He'll play back the movie of all the people in our lives. And we'll see that difficult different people were invitations for me to change me. My spouse was calculated perfectly for me to become a better me. A better husband, a better wife, a better father, a better mother, a better daughter-in-law, a better son-in-law. They were sent to me to become more integral in the workplace, to be more compassionate with people who perhaps just needed a smile and not a whole lot more. All the difficult people were sent in my life, not for me to change them, for me to change me. That's the purpose of different difficult people being sent to me. And I will end off, and I mean it.
In other words, every person you live in your life,
that's right. That's right. Correct. That's exactly the point. I will end off that in the end of time we're told by Yomahu Yi Hashem Echad Ushmo Echad that at the end of time God's name will be one. What does it mean God's name will be one? That during the lifetime I experience difficult people and I usually interpret them as bad. They're not good. And I blame them or I'm angry at God. But if God really is in the picture, and His purpose is not to hurt me, not to punish me, His purpose is to help me become a better father, better husband, better wife, better mother. And the way he does it is by sending the people that are going to press my weak buttons, my sensitive spots. Because the only way I'm ever going to change is practice, exercise. So God sends me the precise people that will test my patience, test what's inside of me, test my responsibility to being a husband, to being a father, to being involved with the children, to being more responsible in how I control my eyes, how I control my appetite, how I control my behavior, how I control my mind, how I control my words. He's going to send people that are going to test me again and again and again. And it's not to hurt me. It's not to get me to change anyone else other than myself. God knows that no one will change themselves except by force. And so God invented marriage and children and the workplace to force me to change. And if I think it's about changing them, I've misunderstood the purpose of God sending me in this world. I'm not here to fix anybody. I'm not here to fix anybody. I'm here to fix me. And when I leave this world, the children we leave behind, the spouse we leave behind, the people we leave behind, what will they remember us for? How much they tried to change us? Or will they remember that we changed because that person changed in the way they were to us? That person found a deeper compassion, a deeper appreciation, and verbalized it. And years before, they weren't like that. When we change the people in our lives. That's the only way that works. I'll end off, and I do mean it, that gratitude and appreciation is the cure of complaining. And if I think I owe you a complaint for what I don't like about you, and there's plenty I don't like about the people in my life, if I believe I do owe you my opinion about what I don't like, by the same logic, I at least owe you appreciation for what I do like. Shalom and shalom. The greeting and the goodbye. In fact, goodbye, linguist tells us, comes from God be with ye. It's a blessing. May God be with you. Even if there was differences, no, not even if, even though there were differences between the greeting and the goodbye, I still bless the God be with you. Because I want to remind you that whatever differences came between us, it's in the context of, I love you and I'm happy you're in my life. It's not too late to turn up the volume of our smiles, our greetings, our hugs and our kisses to those most important in our lives, especially when we come home at work, when we leave the home during the day, and do that thousands of times in our lifetime. Thank you for your patience. So it's a late hour.
Right, right.
At the same time, it's not really a buffering because you're still saying something negative.
Right, question. What do you do when you start with a compliment and then you say, but what I don't like about you is the following. What I'm recommending is that the but is going to destroy the compliment. The but really basically erases everything that came before it. So we can play semantics here and say, well, instead of saying but, we have to say and. So I haven't like killed everything I just said, which was nice about you. But essentially, the real message we're saying tonight is not necessarily use a compliment that now I've got credit, I can blast you. But much rather, start loving you differently. Start enjoying you differently. Start appreciating you differently. And verbalize that. Verbalize it either vocally with my mouth, communicate it in a letter. Communicate even a FedEx to your own spouse can be very powerful. A love note, a post-it, an email, a fax, any which way that a person says, I love you because, and fills in the blank. What I love about you, what your devotion, your responsibility, your loyalty to the family, to the children. Whatever it is that a person can find to compliment and appreciate, that is what's going to show the other person, oh, you're loving me, you're appreciating me, you're grateful to me. That is what's going to make them want to feel differently towards you.
Even when they don't deserve it.
The wording of King Solomon is, Kamay milpanim kein lev ha'adam la'adam. Just like water reflects a face, so is the heart of one person to another. If I want to change the feelings of resentment or anger or bitterness that may have been reinforced and compounded over years, If I want to turn that around, says King Solomon, just like you frown at me when I frown at you, but you smile at me when I smile at you, we do the same thing when we think and feel about the other person. Even if they're not there, they will think and feel in correspondence. When we feel grateful, appreciative, even though there's things I've got to complain about, and I feel a right to, but you know what? Let me try this recipe. Let's see what happens when I change my feelings of appreciation. And instead of saying, you know what, I like you, but, and killing the appreciation, let's stick with appreciation, see what happens. The person's heart will change towards you. It's in psychology, they call it the law of reciprocation. That ultimately, a human being wants to give back in the same way that they received. You hurt me, it's only a matter of time before I find a way to hurt you back. You show love to me, devotion, loyalty. You take my side when I'm wrong, but you take my side because that's loyalty. Ooh, in front of the mother-in-law and the father-in-law, when you know I'm wrong, and in front of them you take my side, and afterwards you say you didn't agree with me, but loyalty says you stand up with me in front of others. Whoa, what's that going to do to my feeling of wanting to be loyal to you? Look at Abraham. Abraham, the most sensitive human being about kindliness and about decency, morality, integrity, honesty. And he nurtured in his household his nephew and brother-in-law, Lot. This young man, Lot, he became a gangster. He goes and joins Sodom, a community of liars and cheats, people filled with greed. And what happens? Abraham says to Lot, you know what? We've been living together, but you're not behaving honestly. Your shepherds are deliberately taking your cattle and eating in the private property. I can't have it anymore. Listen, there's a difference here that is not resolvable. You go to the left, I'll go to the right. You go to the right, I'll go to the left. We have to depart. But I want to tell you something, Lot, my dear nephew. If you ever need me, I'll be there for you. And this is in chapter 13, in Genesis. Chapter 14, God says, okay, Abraham, let's test your integrity. You said you're going to be there for him? This gangster, this liar, this cheat, this greedy guy, who you spent years trying to nurture, and this is how what he becomes? That's a big letdown. He's your brother-in-law and nephew. God sends kings to capture Lot. And what does Abraham do? Puts his entire life on the line. You know what that means? His whole future. He puts his life on the line. He risks his life to save the life of Lot. Why? Why didn't Abraham just say, you know what? Min Hashemayim. God is punishing him. He got captured. I can't risk my life to save him, of course, because that would be risking me, my future, and the promise God gave to me in chapter 15 that I'm going to father an entire nation. It's a pity, but you know, that's justice, I guess. Especially he's so wicked. I can fully understand the guy deserved that he was coming to him. No! He immediately harnessed his resources and went out and saved Lot. Why? Because differences has nothing to do with loyalty! You're my family! Family? Oh, devotion! Family? Oh, loyalty! Family? Oh, trust! Trust, devotion, loyalty, love has nothing to do with performance! I don't like you because of the way you behave. You're not religious as me. You don't go to shul as Mesmer. What's that got to do with loyalty? What's that got to do with shalom? God says the two have nothing to do with each other. And that's why God says, I'll love you even if you don't behave the right way. There's an accountability in the end. But in the meantime, I'm not here to judge you. So Abraham understood that his loyalty was not tarnished for the fact that his nephew was a wicked person. Wicked. That's how far it went. Yeah.
I think it's true about that. Your son's playing basketball and you ask him to stop. He doesn't stop.
Right.
If you do that, you go play with him. Go move to another room and end up somewhere else.
Question.
My words aren't going to mean anything because I'm going to place to you.
Question. What do we do? You got a son, a teenager, playing basketball. You ask him to stop, he just woke you up on a Saturday afternoon. And he carries on. Insensitive, disrespectful. This is an opportunity for discussion, communication. If I get angry, if I shout, if I become accusative and tell him how disrespectful, what a low life. I can't, you know, I can tell you this, dear son. In one day of your accumulative disrespectful comments is more than I was disrespectful to my parents my whole lifetime. Guilt, 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 guilt. I can start giving speeches and lectures and do a good job of it. Bottom line is, if my son is being disrespectful, and openly so, this is an opportunity for me to understand there's probably something to it. There's something that he either doesn't get or doesn't understand of what I represent. I have to ask myself, what might it be in his life that I have not been there for as a father, that he does not feel the sensitivity either to be careful in the first place not to play basketball when I'm sleeping, or after I've made a respectful request for him to stop, he disregards it and continues. If I talk about how he's got to change and make it all about him, as much as I think I'm right and he owes it to me, covered, you have to honour your father. In fact, you're promised long life if you honour your father. Guess what you get if you don't honour your father? Right? I could give him a whole long lecture, but it's all about changing him. What I might need to do is find the right opportunity to use this incident for a communication. Son, I've been thinking about it. When you continue playing basketball, I said to myself, you know what? I've probably hurt you. Because I know that you are a sensitive person. Even though you don't always want to show it, but you're a sensitive person. And that you know that deep down, I've been a loving father, but I have a feeling, when I'm thinking about it, there must be a reason why it's difficult for you to stop playing when I make a respectful request for you not to. Now, I don't know if he's ready yet to you know, respond. I might not be even ready to open that up. But maybe I need, as a father, to investigate and explore in this direction, what is it about me that he doesn't have that sensitivity when I make this simple request and start changing me?
So the guilt always comes back to the parents. We always feel guilty.
No, it's not necessarily guilt. It doesn't have to be guilt. It doesn't have to be guilt. You know what? Let's say I've done a lot of good things, and my child has still decided to be different and contrary and disrespectful and defiant. Right? And I've done a lot of good things. I really have. And so there's no way, they're not even room for guilt. Now what am I supposed to do? And the answer is turn up the volume of love. Turn up the volume of acceptance. Turn down the volume of judgment, judging. Turn down the volume of what I don't like about what they wear. It doesn't stop me setting boundaries. I can still say, son, I want to tell you something. I'm going to love you no matter what. I do not approve of your hairstyle. I approve of you. I don't like your hairstyle. If I make the hairstyle you, which means when I don't approve of your hairstyle, I don't approve of you, I basically insulted him. But I can say it's not to my taste. I can say the clothes are not to my taste. But I want you to know something. I can see through your clothes. And I can see through your hairstyle. And I will still always love you, no matter what. If I can communicate that, I've got a much better chance of my child understanding that, yes, Dad doesn't like everything I say, do, not all my choice of friends, but he hasn't rejected me. He still loves me, doesn't judge me for it. He's entitled to say what he doesn't like. The question is, how do I say it? Do I destroy the child in the process and make the whole thing about the size of the yarmulke, the shape of the yarmulke, the color of the yarmulke, the texture of the yarmulke, black, green, red, leather, right? And the whole religion hangs on the yarmulke? The whole religion hangs on his behavior? Or no, my relationship with you is not dependent on your behavior. I'm going to love you anyway. It doesn't stop me approving or disapproving. That's the difference the kid needs to get. He can handle that. What he can't handle is me keeping quiet out of weakness, so I'm scared. I'm like, oh my gosh, if I say anything about the yarmulke and the hairstyle and their friends. So I just bite my lips and just swallow it all, be loving and accepting and unconditional love, and guess what? He knows I'm a phony. He knows I'm faking it. And he's waiting for Dad to have the guts to say, you know, son, I really don't like your hair. I go for short. I go for dignified stuff. But when I insult him, that's what's going to hurt. He wants me to say what I don't like, but not with the insults. And he wants the love. He needs love. And they will crave it. And they will crave it till they die. They will crave it when they're financially independent. They'll crave it even when they're married. And even if they don't say they do, that's because they've given up. That's because they don't. Dad will never change. Mom will never change. But guess what? What happens if they do change? The child will be ready to re-embrace it. They may not want to at first because they don't want to get hurt all over again. Maybe mom's going to become judgmental very quickly once they feel that they got a little bit of an in. No! If they really do change, they've always got a second chance for their children. No matter how much we messed up with the teenagers, no matter how much we messed up when they're young, it's never too late because kids, by definition, crave mom and dad's love.
Maybe the parents say, "Oh, they're
children, so the child will change." Yeah. Yeah, that's possible. I'll take one last question and let everyone get to sleep. So the gentleman at the back, I'll take this, you as well. So, right. Well, how do I apologize? Essentially, I think what your question really is not how do I say sorry, but you know, how do I apologize without destroying my own self-respect and dignity in my kids' eyes? The answer is, if I get into the habit of apologizing, which is a terrible habit to get into, because it means I'm continuing the same mistakes, but if I do overcome what it takes to apologize to my kid, it will be much harder for me to continue that behavior. If I don't apologize, I'm much more likely to start justifying, well, look, I am the father, someone has to discipline him, he's coming to him, and you know, he needs to be put in his place. I mean, he has to be disciplined. And I find all sorts of justifications, rationalizations. If I've hurt him, if I've wronged him, I do need to apologize and say it as straight as that, and become more sensitive. My son, even if I think I've wiped the floor with myself by apologizing, bottom line, they'll respect me more for it. They'll respect dad, they'll respect mum. They'll see that I'm struggling with it. It's not easy. And if I admit that I'm struggling, it's also helpful. With younger children, it can hurt them sometimes to keep apologizing. It's not good. It destroys our credibility. But with the older children, let them know that, you know what, I have a problem with my anger, and I'm still struggling with it, and I'm not going to stop struggling. I'm going to work on it until I get it out of my system. And I apologize to you because what I said may have been correct. How I said it and how I blew it, I was way off, completely wrong, and I apologize for that. I hurt you, and I had no right to do that. Yeah. You had a quick question, and then we'll leave it. Right.
So, on our Sinai, didn't we say Nasir and Ishmael?
Right.
Is that based on beforehand?
Nasir and Ishmael. I will do whatever you say, and then I will understand. So if there's a parallel, surely that works as well. The parallel of God being a loving parent is not meant to be taken applied in every single context. The context that it's stated in is in the context of discipline, like Hashem discipline, like a father disciplines his son. It's actually in this week's parasha, Parshas Ekev. I think it's in chapter 8 of Deuteronomy. Just like a son is chastised and corrected by his father, so Hashem also corrects us. So that's one context. Another context is, you are my child no matter what. No matter if you behave like my child or don't behave like my child. So the applications don't work in every single other area. Like you're saying, Nasir and Ishma, the child has to simply do and not understand. In the early age, I tell my child, he has to do this. I don't owe him an explanation. And if I give him one, he probably won't understand. It's too young, too immature. As he gets older, if I continue giving him the orders and don't explain why, I will raise a child that will resent me, because he'll be a robot. That's not the purpose of raising this child. The purpose of raising the child is for him to be independent, not dependent. So there comes a point where I've got to explain the nishma. I can't just tell him naaseh.